This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Prosecutors open against Lindsay Clancy by telling a Plymouth jury this case has nothing to do with postpartum psychosis and everything to do with a woman watching the clock, sitting there plotting, just somewhere out of nowhere, decided, you know what, I just think I'm going to take out my family today and myself, and what the hell? Nothing. Nothing about the 13 meds, the waving her hands, going to hospital after hospital, provider after provider, saying, I need help. Prosecution doesn't, because that has to do with mental health. And since a lot of court systems, including Massachusetts, want to operate like it's 1898 instead of today, and they probably say, why don't you go check out leeching? See if leeching, ask your doctor if leeching is right for you. They want to basically railroad her and say that she's just a horrible person and none of the mental health stuff actually matters, which is really the whole crux of the damn case. We're going to be breaking this down today. The prosecution's opening statements, the defense's opening arguments, a little bit about what Patrick, dad, had to say here, or the husband had to say, who still stands by his wife. And we welcome your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We're also going to be getting into, because we have to, Brian Koberger. And Lil Bri from behind bars is getting bored and wanted to raise his hand and say, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. And somehow think that him saying that means anything.
Any day we can torture him more is a great day.
Oh, my God.
So I'm all in.
Anytime a broomstick can enter one orifice and come out the other of him would be a great fucking day.
As Gonzalez says, the big D.
Yeah. The big D with a big B, a big broom right there. Don't even take the head off the broom. Just lay the whole fucking thing right through. Anyway, we're going to get into all of that. Your thoughts in the comment section as we work our way through all of this. Bob Mata was going to be with us, but it is summertime and he is on the road. So he got me and Robin today to break all this down. Robin, let's start with this. The state's timeline has her timing the drive to a restaurant. And they say they're trying to make a big deal. The family didn't normally get takeout from there. Well, big frickin' deal. I get takeout once a week, at least from one restaurant I've never used before. That's not that crazy. But according to them, well, that's a lot of that. That's something. And then sending the children's father out to get the food. The defense doesn't dispute any of it. The prosecution wants the jury to believe this is evidence she knew what she was doing, and hope they don't understand that people in psychosis can actively plan things. It doesn't mean they're sitting in the corner crying and rocking back and forth. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they can look just like you and me. How do you think this goes? There's a lot of understanding of mental health that's going to be required of 18 people. Do you think they'll get it?
No, I gotta tell you, I watched the entire opening statements, prosecution, defense, and I didn't know anyone involved here except we've been covering Lindsay and the husband a little bit, obviously, in the coming, in the weeks prior to this. And I listened to the prosecution get up there, and she's making her statement. And Jennifer Sprague is the one that did it, I think, right? Or is it?
Yeah, it was Jennifer.
Yeah, so Jennifer gave the opening, and she did okay. You know, it was the typical what we expected, and, you know, trying to disparage her and say how premeditated it was and that you're going to hear this, this, and this. And it was everything I expected, no real earth-shattering things there. And as they're doing it, the camera kept panning to Lindsay and the lawyer, Kevin Reddington.
Yeah.
And first of all, I'm watching Lindsay, and her nonverbals were extremely congruent with someone who lives in a lot of guilt, a lot of remorse, and without showmanship. I mean, so never once did she look up. I mean, think back to Donald Adelson. Every time Donna gave a tear, she's like, who's looking? Who's looking? Who's looking? No. If you look at Lindsay's nonverbals, if you haven't had a chance to look at the opening statements, look at them, look at her completely collapsed in on herself.
Yeah.
It was all for her. Because she's uncontrollable, inconsolable as well, because of she knew, very witting of the horrendous things she went through and she did, and also what she knows what she's about to go through and put everyone else through.
Yeah.
And then the master stood up. I was watching Kevin Reddington, didn't know anything about him before this, and I, from the outside appearance, I'm looking at what I thought was a curmudgeonly old man that kind of was smirking a little bit when prosecution is going. I'm like, oh man, I don't know about this. And then he stood up.
It's Matlock.
He began speaking. Oh my God. He was all in. He completely eviscerated the opening statement of prosecution, in my opinion, without being mean, without doing anything. You could tell this 75-year-old defense attorney with amazing credentials. I was wondering, can he bring the energy? He's got the reps. Yes, yes, yes. He totally laid out. I mean, you could tell there's a connection that he had with her. He was like by her side in the hospital room trying to get access to her. He was masterful. He laid out exactly what he's going to do. He had the old-time charts, you know, just holding mm-hmm. up what things were. He had depth of field of everything coming out of his mouth. He was fluid. He was great. And so I thought in that opening statement, it laid out exactly what this case is going to be about. And he laid it out in such a way that, listen, here's what you don't know about psychosis. Here's what you're going to find out about psychosis. Because she was in psychosis. And to your opening point, I know a long narrative answer because I was just so compelled by by the opening statements, that when you do the research, and the prosecution was saying that, you know, she was pre-planned and all this, she didn't look deranged or whatever, you know, that you would think, you know, when you have a caricature in your mind of someone who's in a psychosis, you're thinking of something you've seen in the movies. That's not the way it works. Psychosis and hearing voices and being in that kind of state can be weeks and months and sometimes longer than that before you actually come out of it. So it's all everyday behavior with something on top of it. And that's what she had. That's what she's suffering because he's laying out the medication she's under. And again, that was just the opening statement. After the opening statement, it was like, hey, can we all vote now? I mean, it was really, really good. Anyway.
It was. And the thing is, in a trial like this, and by the way, Bob's in the chat.
Yep.
Because he's on the road. So Bob will be interacting with us that way today. We'll try and watch for some of your reactions there, Bob, and reiterate them into the conversation. The likability factor in this case is going to be important.
I thought it was going to be.
As much as anybody is like, well, it's not about that. You're right. There's so many things a trial is not about, but ultimately is, because you're dealing with human beings, and human beings are going to make decisions based on whatever speaks to them and comes across as authentic and true to them as possible. And I'll tell you what, my reaction after watching those opening statements from the prosecution felt like the shitty babysitter that you get as a child when the good one's not available. It's just where it's like, I have rules. I'm going to tell you what they are. They don't make a lot of sense. They don't necessarily conform to reality or how life is actually lived. But I'm going to tell you this, and you better think this or not think this. I really don't care that much. I'm not that convincing with my arguments, and I'm doing my job, and I'm getting a paycheck. That's what it felt like. It did not feel like a person that was convicted of anything they were saying out loud. Yeah. I don't know if she actually was or not. I didn't read to me like she was. But, you know, she's doing her job nonetheless, and this is the case that she's been assigned to handle. Then you get him up there and you get, you know, old school attorney. They don't make him like this anymore, guy.
No, thank
and
God
it was
him.
Like, holy shit. And it gave me a little bit of hope that maybe this won't be a hung jury. I do not think you get a guilty verdict on this. I don't know that you get a not guilty by reason of insanity, but I think you get a hung jury. At least that's where I've been saying from day one. But I tell you, I'm swaying a little bit more to maybe not guilty by reason of insanity, where she can go live the rest of her life in a mental health institution, which is what she wants to do.
Yeah. You know, and that goes to, I think, what we've been asking ourselves and covering all week on this. And that is, you know, what's really justice here? You know, because the three young, beautiful lives are gone. Her life is ruined. Her ex-husband's life is ruined. Lives are ruined here. So what's really justice here? And I think once you saw Kevin Reddington get up there, I feel safe that justice will be done. And that is bringing attention to the mental health struggles that she went through and that a lot of people go through. I think he is going to do, because even just in the opening statement, he made a great argument again about what was going on with her medications, with her mental health. And so I think the real justice is here, like we said at the very beginning, you know, a couple episodes ago, was it'll be her getting the help that she needs, and really a system getting a boost of understanding about the mental health struggles that women sometimes go through as postpartum and psychosis and all these things. So regardless of the outcome, because either way, she's behind bars the rest of her life, right?
Yeah. Robin, I mean, and look, and I don't know how many people are on the prosecution team, but the person who gave the opening statement.
Yeah, I was wrong on that. It's it was Shannon, not Jennifer.
Did it? I mean, younger. I don't know how experienced she is. I'm not here to cast judgment, but you know, she's, I'm going to guess 30s, 40s, somewhere in that vicinity, you know, has some experience here in life. Like anybody of that mm-hmm. age would, but then you get him. He's like, what, in his 70s?
75.
75.
And decorated.
And decorated. And how, I guess my question is, how powerful is it to a jury? How powerful is it from one human to another when you have someone of a generation? Because let's be honest, that generation, they didn't have the mental health resources available to them that younger generations have had. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that is in bulk, in a larger number, a less of an understanding of mental health issues. I'm not saying it's anyone's fault. It's just generational. What you are brought up around, what you are educated and what you understand is what it is. But to have someone of that generation standing up and advocating for it, that stands out because you don't see a lot of it from that group for that reason. Again, not a disparagement, but it is what it is. So when you have someone of that generation who comes across as likable, who is educated, who has a good track record, who is decorated, all of that, that is advocating for someone much younger on a topic that typically that generation doesn't speak of that eloquently or with that much understanding, does that put a lot more weight on what he's delivering versus if there was a 35-year-old version of him delivering it?
Yeah, I think it's a part of it. He's got the reps, you know, and Shannon didn't have the reps. And that's okay because that's what life is. That's what gives it to you. And mm-hmm. and I know that the judge gave instructions at the beginning, you know, not to make it emotional. You got to go on facts and data. I know Bob's weighing in, you know, that's really important, but he also agrees that his opening was phenomenal. But here's a key takeaway for everyone absorbing this. It's a lot to your point there, Tony, but also on top of it, he looked like to me, he is a father taking care of his daughter who just went through this. I mean, that's the tenor he gave off. There was such a connection you felt between him and her about his caring and depth of field, about him taking care of her. And that just resonates so strong. And then when you actually do some research, first of all, when he says who's going to come up and speak on her behalf, we've covered this so often on so many cases. When you have a true nutter doing horrendous things, no one stands by them. Who came up and stood by Donna Adelson? Who came up and stood by the psycho mom who wrote about her, you know, husband being killed and you know, the children's book? Corey Richens, right?
Corey Richens, yeah.
Lori Dale Belvallo. Who stood up behind these women? And to a lesser degree, but still an abuse side, you know, you have Ruby Frankie. You know, no one stands behind nutters. Who's standing behind Lindsay? Everyone.
Yeah,
absolutely. And on top of that, you just have this deep connection. The fact is, when you look it up, I looked up. I said, Kevin Reddington, this guy's really good. He is not court appointed. And apparently, the family, her parents, have gone completely broke, paying for the defense of her, knowing she's still going to be behind bars no matter what. Again, people that have unhealthy relationships don't do these types of things. That's why the likelihood of psychosis and being under that kind of influence is much higher.
Well, the prosecution's whole theory is really just, it's bare bones. It's very simple. She didn't want to be a mom anymore, so she killed her kids. Okay, well, what basis do you have?
I'm waiting
to see. We're going
like
to
work.
I mean, they have the floor right now, so we will see what they're going to bring out to back up that opinion. Right. We haven't seen it yet, so I'll give them that. But I mean, there has been nothing that's come out as of yet that really points to this being a case like that where somebody's wanting to get out of a relationship and does all this sort of stuff. Well, the only reps we see here are a woman who has struggled begging healthcare providers for help to get her out of the nightmare in which her brain has been putting her in. That's it. We're not seeing the struggles or the let's escape attempts like we've seen in other cases, like Scott Peterson's or you name it, where Corey Richens, where they're looking for their off ramp. There's none of that here, but it's being pitched to us and to the jury as if this is that without the material, if you will. I mean, does that make it easier? I mean, because I think that I mean, in some ways, that could be successful for a prosecution, because sometimes simpler is better. And then people don't have to think that deep. They don't have a whole lot to go. And if they just say, see, she did this because of that. How do you not see this? Some people are going to be like, yeah, that must be right. Because that's how a lot of people work. They're arguing about the voices that she heard, that she talked about. Oh, she only heard them once and then it stopped. Okay, and yes, I don't think they're disputing that. Why are you telling us what that means? You're not a psychiatrist. You're not a psychologist. You're not one that can really interpret this. I mean, it's being interpreted by an attorney. That's why you have experts that come in and do this. An attorney, you know, it's not going to be interpreting forensic DNA information, although they attempt to all the time, and then pitching it to the jury. But again, that's where the experts are going to come in. And I don't think they're going to find any experts on the prosecution side. They're going to be necessarily agreeing word for word with the simplistic explanation of what was going on in her mind, unless they find a really shitty expert witness to do so, which, I mean, they exist. So who knows? Yeah. Who knows?
And Bob, you know, our great Bob Mott is agreeing too that you know, Kevin Reddington knows the case like the back of his hands. And you could see it in the first couple seconds there, just listening to his opening statement. It's the thing that really got me also, since you brought up the prosecution's opening statement, was, again, they're framing it as a murder-suicide attempt. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't fit the data of, again, I know that you can't really look as past as prologue with research, but when you're looking at the research, this is not the type of individual that does murder-suicide. And then if you just remove the suicide part of it, because again, their claim in the opening statement was that she just didn't like the work. She just didn't want to be a mother. It was too much for her. But there's nothing that actually supports that, because the parents were there. She's getting help. She's getting all these things. Yeah. She loved doing these things. She's a real go-getter. And so if you didn't like being a mother so much that you kill your kids, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
That's why she committed suicide. Like you said, I think it looked to me, if you're looking behaviorally, like the prosecution got assigned this case, isn't emotionally invested nearly as much as Kevin Reddington is. And that goes a long way when you're presenting facts, data, and information to juries, I would think.
Bob says they misdiagnosed her initially when they failed to incorporate the fact that she had a manic episode after the birth of their second child. Yeah, they did. I think she's been misdiagnosed for a long time, and I think another piece of this that the prosecution, you know, is trying to lean into is, well, why didn't anybody do anything more? Well, we're learning they did a lot, and we're going to get it more into that. But there's certain reps that come, and I thought Patrick's testimony was very powerful yesterday. Just very matter of fact of, here's what I was thinking. He said years to digest this and be able to deliver this, you know, in a calm way to an audience, that, you know, the birth of their second child, she had postpartum depression. I mean, okay. And so when you've been through that hellstorm once, which in itself is a hellstorm, for the person who's experiencing it and the person and the people who are trying to care for that person, don't wish it on my worst fucking enemy. And then she has another child, and the experiences seem somewhat reminiscent of the last time. You're not thinking that the person is going to go to quite
that extreme.
And maybe that's a failure of human beings and our brains and our minds of not thinking the worst could happen here, even though she said maybe the worst could happen here. But it is what it is. That's more of an that to me is more of an example and more of an understanding of what was going on here and why he would have gone out to get the food, because he wasn't thinking that she could possibly go to that sort of an extent. I know the prosecution is going to spin it a different way, but all these things they seem to try and spin on the prosecution, I feel like could very easily backfire under just the slightest bit of scrutiny. I think they really, if they want to win this case, they're really going to have to watch how they're throwing things out to this jury and just going, here's the facts, accept them. Because I think everything's going to be countered very eloquently by the defense of Lindsey Clancy.
Yeah, and what's important too, is I think people keep getting wrapped up. It's easy to get wrapped up because she's on the defense on this, is thinking that she's arguing for freedom.
Yeah.
No, it's completely admitting she did it. So we're really just talking about what the result of this trial is for her. So I just looked it up. So if Lindsey Clancy wins, not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility, that's actually how the statute reads there. Massachusetts version of insanity defense, she does not go free and she does not receive a traditional criminal sentence. If the jury, so the initial commitment typically 6 months. So it's a long time still. That's why it's easy to get caught up with her. She didn't, not culpable of doing it. No, they totally accept responsibility for doing it. And the husband,
yeah,
too, is, I think what I found really interesting too, with the husband being divorced and having moved on, I thought about this. Does it actually help or hinder the credibility? I think it helps because he's moved on from her. There's no longer this marriage relationship, no longer necessarily standing by her side, literally, but able to move on because he made a choice that he's going to move on with his life. But because of him knowing her so well, isn't resentful, isn't going to sink her boat, is trying to still get her the help that he thinks she needs as well. I think that says a lot. Like, he doesn't emotionally still connect it to her as a husband, but still able to stand by her, saying it was more. I mean, can you imagine a scenario where someone moves on, gets married, divorces her, and eviscerates her, and stands by the prosecution saying that, you know, that she didn't do all this. She made, it was premeditated. She took advantage of me. She totally manipulated me to go out and take out all these things, but he's not saying that. Yeah. So I think that says a lot as well.
I want to address a couple comments before we move on to the defense. I didn't like that she was the one who decided what medications to take and when. She didn't. She was prescribed medications, and then some. It is true that she did take some, maybe not directly as prescribed. She thought she knew better. Yes, that is a prime example of her brain not working well. Do you know the amount of like paranoia that goes on with this sort of disorder and psychosis and shit that goes along with it? Means you're not making educated decisions, and your brain is telling you, I should do this, I shouldn't do this. That's why we have doctors. That's why we have providers. That's why you can't just go out to Walgreens and decide, I'm going to buy a bunch of SSRIs and antipsychotics and this or that, along with some Tic Tacs for fun, because there's medical professionals who are supposed to know what the other hand is doing and administer it responsibly. And yes, people who get their medications prescribed in this sort of state are not exactly in the best state to know what to take or when to take them effectively or correctly. That's why she was misdiagnosed. She wasn't being treated effectively, and she should have never been in the position that she was because of all these misdiagnoses. So your argument there that, oh, she was doing this for that reason, is complete and utter fucking bullshit. You are actually reinforcing the counter argument with that sort of statement. I'm sorry. That's the fucking reality of it.
And a thing to keep in mind also, that's very hard, and I get it, it's very hard to understand what psychosis looks like if you've never been around it before. I haven't been around psychosis. I've been around people who've gone through withdrawal before, though. And when you go around people who are going through withdrawal and severe withdrawal, and you start seeing and hearing things because they're not actually there, here's what it looks like. And here's what people going through psychosis look like to others on the outside. Because you're looking for signs, because a lot of it was on the husband should have seen something, or she should have been aware of it. They look and interact with the world in a completely normal way. There's no deviation from the pattern. What happens is that voices get added in, visions get added in. And so what happens is it becomes, you have no idea. You have no idea that someone is in the middle of a psychosis potentially just because, and that's why they're so rare. It's extremely rare. It's a very low percentage of people that actually have these type of postpartum psychosis. I mean, I think it's like 1% or 3%. I mean, it's very, very low.
It's
very
one
rare.
In a thousand.
But it is so undetectable by someone on the outside. And potentially someone from the inside as well, because ask someone going through, again, I only have the reference of withdrawal, seeing someone, like I've listened to people tell me that they're hearing someone talking to them right now as they're completely interacting normal with the world, but they're hearing the voices. They're feeling people touch them. It's really some crazy, wacky shit. So as Bob says, let's wait and see the evidence come through.
When I see she's gaslighting y'all, bless your heart. Bless your heart that you've never had to be close to anything like this, that you have the gift of never being touched by this in a way that you were forced to understand, and you're able to live in such a world where this sort of thing doesn't exist. It does. I'm sorry to break it to you, but if you can stay in your bubble over there and enjoy the benefits of that, more power to you. But you don't need to insert your voice in places that you don't understand.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.